Okay, so this is another interview with Manual Therapy Blog. Today we're talking with Earl Pettman. He is a lot of different things. He's lives in Canada, helped found NIOMT, North American Institute of Orthopedic Manual Therapy. He's a physiotherapist in Abbotsford. Uh-huh. And I don't know how many years you've been practicing, but you can help fill us in. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself? So that I don't get anything wrong.
Yeah, well, I qualified in England in 1972. So I guess I've been working for 45 years. 2 years in England, then emigrated to Canada. So I've been living in Canada for 43 years. And basically that's where I began to run into manual therapy and then eventually began teaching manual therapy. So been in Abbotsford for 39 years. So staying in a community for that length of time has been very informative in itself. Mm. And my mission, if I have a mission, is to really focus on community care so that as a clinic we really get feeling out that we care for the community, we care for families, church groups, and so on. And I think it's working because we also have people who pop in on a routine basis for assessments and so on, which we don't charge for. And lots of young athletes will come in. They can't afford the treatment, but that's fine. So we've obviously got the reputation as well that we will care for people whether they can pay for it or not. And I think that's been huge in terms of getting inside a community and being a permanent fixture in that community. I think community physiotherapy as community medicine is really the way we should be going rather than the corporate side mm-hmm. of physical therapy, which I really don't like.
Well, that's actually fantastic to hear because the times that I've been in class with you, I've heard you tell many different things, many stories, but I haven't heard you say that one. So that's really nice to hear.
Yeah, and of course, that's why I blended in so well at Andrews University. And I've been teaching there for 25 years. Wow. And it is, the university is dedicated to missions. Everything they do is voluntary and kind of fits in with my ideological view of what physical therapy should be. And of course, they've latched on to my ideas, mm-hmm. and they think that's great because of their background. Mm-hmm. So it's really been a synergy of ideas, and I just hope to keep teaching there for a few more years. Obviously, at some point, I've got to retire.
Well, hopefully not too soon so that other people can still learn from you.
Yeah, I think, physically, especially with my knees, the clinical side probably has a near end at some point, mm-hmm. just because of the stress it puts on your body. Manual therapy is not an easy form of physical therapy. It's extremely arduous, strenuous, especially if you're doing 10 hours a day without a break, which is what I do.
Oh, that's a lot.
So that's obviously got a limited time, but probably like an old wine. I think teachers tend to improve with time. They have more stories to tell, plus they're more likely to tell you exactly what they feel and what they would do in the clinic rather than what they think you want to hear mm-hmm. that you should do.
Well, backing up just a little bit, you were saying that you're originally from England. What first got you interested in physiotherapy? Or how did you come about to that decision that that's what you wanted to be in life?
My original plan was to go into medicine, and I had offers to go into medical school. And although I did take the exams, I really was in a state of burnout, like a lot of students
mm-hmm.
who are coming to that point. So I decided to take a year out of study and thoroughly enjoyed it. I became a hospital porter. I used to try transport eyes for the eye bank. I rigged antennae on people's roofs. It was really, you know, quite an interesting year. Got to know people rather than just the inside of a school. But it was my father who, and I really, at that point, didn't want to go back or go to medicine.
Mm-hmm. So you'd made that decision.
Yeah, I'd made that decision, but I didn't know what to do. And my father had one of his businesses that he ran or managed was it like a healthcare center, and they hired a physical therapist. So he said to me, well, you know, you might not want to go into medicine, but you probably want to still be in healthcare. Why don't you talk to this physical therapist? So I did, and he gave me a vague idea of what was happening. So just by pure chance, I went for an interview at Nottingham, got in, but having got in, I still didn't really understand what I was doing. Like physiotherapy was still a very strange area to me.
I didn't
even know what it represented. once I got in, of course, my studies I'd already done for university made it relatively easy for me to get through all the like physics and physiology and so on. So I found it, you know, really quite exciting. When I left school and I went to work in a hospital, it was one of the most awful experiences because I got bored so quickly doing what I was supposed to do as a physical therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have anything like the dream that I had had as a student.
Right.
So I actually quit physiotherapy for about 6 months and went into painting and decorating with my fiance, now wife. And we earned enough money to tour Europe for a few weeks. And when we came back, we realized, okay, this is not where we want to spend the rest of our lives. My father had been in the Canadian Air Force. So he kept talking to me about this strange place, Canada, how wonderful it was, especially for young people.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to go, much to the horror of my parents. We emigrated to Canada. And it was there when I was in Canada that I ran into people like Cliff Fowler,
mm-hmm.
Dave Lamb,
mm-hmm.
John Oldham, Syriax, Maitland. And these represented a new world to me, an exciting world.
Yeah.
And the most exciting thing that ever happened to me was one of my friends, John Oldham, giving me Syriax's Orthopedic Medicine Volume 1
mm-hmm.
with all his theories on differential diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And I must confess, having read that, and I've read it several times, my feeling of what I'd learned at school, and certainly what I'd learned in the hospital, was that I almost felt betrayed, because looking at what there was out there,
right?
Why did we settle for such a tiny piece of the pie when there's this huge amount to learn and know? And that really was the thrust to get me into manual therapy.
So
been there ever since.
Wow. So your friends Cliff Fowler, David Lamb, who also co-founded NIOPT, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of them and have heard people speak of them, other things, but I haven't heard of John Alden or
John Oldham.
Oldham. So who was he to you?
John Oldham was never been really big into teaching. He's much more into clinical investigation,
mm-hmm.
and he was the therapist who most influenced the study of breathing.
Oh.
Forward head posture,
okay,
and pioneered most of what I teach anyway on the forward head posture and mouth breathing versus nasal breathing, all of its implications and so on. So he has been a really like a pioneer type of spirit, and certainly I know Laurie McLaughlin, mm-hmm. who's also in the field. She was stimulated through him to go on to that. So using a postural respiratory model, became big in my clinic, and then I realized that we really should be teaching this material on courses. It seemed way out there when I first ran into it. It seemed as if it was in far left field. I began to realize very quickly that this was an extremely important part of manual therapy.
Yeah.
So that's who John is.
Okay. Thank you for that. So, by the way, for those who are listening, the beeping you hear in the background is just the door bell or door ringing whenever someone walks in or out. So
it is not my pacemaker.
So those are, you know, wonderful things to learn about you, Earl. You're still practicing quite a bit in the clinic. What are some of the things, and your treatments, as well as what you teach, continually evolve based on what you're learning from patients. What are some of the things that still excite you or are currently exciting you or things that really get you going at the moment? Anything in particular?
Well, one of the reasons I teach, and especially one of the reasons I invite people to my clinic, people like yourself, is that you are all unique, and on a course or in a clinical visit, you may say something that I'm not aware of or teach me something that I'm not aware of. That's the stimulus. In a confined environment like a clinic, it's really hard to just come up with new ideas out of the blue. But with this continuous stream of information from students, other physiotherapists, for example, the Zoas pyramid was not something that just came to me in a dream. I had a therapist from Hawaii who was working with me, and she just happened to say, as we were treating a patient, that she was really quite mystified by why quadratus lumborum was always in spasm with psoas. Like, what was the relationship? And of course, it never occurred to me that there even was a relationship. I used to treat them as separate entities. But when I researched it, I realized they're from the same myomeres, same nerve supply, same location in the spine. One's on the front, one's on the back. It was like, okay. And then started to look more closely. Gail Malloy's work on the hip, indicating it was from lumbosacral instability, thoracolumbar changes. When you're looking at those things close up and you're treating them on a daily basis, you don't tend to have time to stand back. It's a bit like my analogy of the elephant. When people are so close, they're feeling different parts. They never have an idea of the animal they're looking at. But having had this sort of jolt, I managed to step back and I could see that everything in the lower half of the body could be affected or could affect psoas. And then within a few months, putting that together in the clinic and then begin to teach it as the psoas pyramid. Same thing with the trigeminal symptoms. I was aware of the fact that a lot of people were coming in with these bizarre symptoms, but it hadn't really occurred to me the importance of it and how much of it there was. I was more likely to put it down, like many therapists today, to concussive symptoms or psychological symptoms from trauma. And then I ran into a book by a dentist called Gelb. And Gelb had written a book, Head, Neck, and Jaw. Pathology, and in there he made it quite clear that the jaw, because of its trigeminal innervation, was quite capable of giving us headaches, ringing in the ears, even optical problems. And so I started to research it, looking in Gray's Anatomy first. That's where I stumbled across the fact that the trigeminal nucleus, the cervical nucleus, supplied the upper three joints, and from there, boom,
just kept going.
Just
from there.
Take off, and there's so much research now.
It's kind of funny that you bring up Gelb. Through those that I know and some mentors of mine through the Institute of Physical Art, they have a close relationship, or they have a relationship with Michael Gelb in New York, the dentist. So I don't know if it was him
or his son.
Yeah,
Henry Gelb was the dad.
So they have a, I would say, close relationship with him. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So,
small world.
Yeah, small world indeed. One of the things that strikes me, and I'm sure other people, when they take a course from you, Earl, or they just meet you and get to chat with you, is one, how knowledgeable you are about the human body and anatomy, physiology, and especially functional anatomy. So I'd like to ask you a question about that. But before I do, the other thing that also strikes us about you is that you're very approachable, humble, and always giving credit where credit is due. Is that just something that you've learned as a child, or something that you've been humbled by yourself from other people that you kind of feel you have to be that way? Or
yeah, well, I think, my upbringing had a tremendous amount to do with that. My mum and dad were constantly taking in waifs and strays and relatives whose relationships had gone bad. And so caring for other people became almost like a model that you needed to follow, because that's the way it should be. But I think in terms of education, because I said I was going into medicine, one of the traumatic things that happened was that we had a teacher in zoology who did not follow the curriculum and had no intention of following the curriculum. So this entire class,
wow,
which we had of 20 people, all failed. And of course, we were all going on to medicine and higher studies. And earlier than that, I had been, in terms of maths, I was such a dunce in maths. I was in a remedial class. And the first day in this remedial class, so this would have been the third year high school, the first day this teacher opens up and says, "Everybody thinks you're dummies, but I can tell you this, you're not dummies, you just had crappy teachers." Well, by the time she'd finished with us, by the time we went to do our advanced level exam, or and GCEs as they were called, I got a distinction. In other words, like 100%.
Oh.
And very few people in the other classes could believe that. It's like, what? And when you go for that kind of experience, you realize that it doesn't matter what people know. If you can guide them in the correct manner, you can always increase their knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
From the anatomy perspective, it's always been an interest to me ever since I was a boy. But when I took it more seriously going to college, I have one advantage over most people, is that if I read something once, it's in my head and it stays in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have to keep repeating, like learning anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
This enabled me to keep have a Gray's Anatomy in my head, and therefore I could spend much more time looking at structure related to function.
Mm-hmm.
Because the two studies of anatomy are very different. And so that's where I went, using more functional treatments in the clinic. I needed to understand the anatomy, but I needed to understand more about how the anatomy related to that function.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I got into that field of study.
And do you still study anatomy on a routine basis?
All the time. Because if you look on the web, then, as I said, like the knowledge that psoas and quadratus lumborum are linked embryologically. You need the stimulus to go looking for something like that,
mm-hmm.
but it's there. A lot of stuff is being researched and put on the web. And interestingly enough, the researchers, it's like a lot of the trigeminal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
People doing the research do not obviously understand the implications of what they're doing. To them, it's just a research topic.
Right.
And they don't see the clinical significance because, as I said, they're not standing back and trying to look at the overall picture, the big picture.
Very true. So the different students that you get to teach through continuing education, or even those that come into your clinic and that you're mentoring there, what are some of the things that you would like, for those clinicians out there who don't have an opportunity to come take a course from you, or don't have an opportunity to come to Canada and work in a clinic with you, What are some common themes that you see among students that you'd like to help them with or give advice to or pass on knowledge about, you know, for those who are listening out there? Anything come to mind?
Well, I think if you're talking about manual therapists, I think the most important thing is to be honest with yourself and not assume that because you've been taught something, A, it's true, and B, you can do it well. And I think so many people out there are in that boat. And although they're not sure if they can feel or not, they either get disparaged and drop the whole thing, or they just continue making the same mistakes over and over again, which we've all done. And we've all done that in the past. My advice to them is to keep reaching out for more senior therapists, even if it's just a day, to work with them. Keep gleaning from them. Don't forget, look at the people I learned from. Mm-hmm. I had the best teachers in the world, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I know the value of that. You can't be an island unto yourself, and you can't possibly expect to learn everything on your own. This is a collective challenge, and it's a collective profession. Tons of people that are prepared to help other therapists, not necessarily for money. A lot of us will do it for nothing, but you got to reach out and make that effort.
Yeah, that's really good to know. Kind of following along with that, and maybe I'm going off on a tangent here. One of the mentors that you've had, at least I've heard you talk about in courses that you didn't mention earlier, was Olaf Evans.
Oh, yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about your time with him or your time learning the Norwegian system and about him in as an individual or a mentor to you or what you've learned from the Nords?
Yeah, I think one of the things I learned from the Canadians and then eventually helped to contribute to the same pool of ideas was innovation.
Hmm.
Don't sit back and think that, okay, this is all we are going to ever know. Work on things. If there's a problem in the clinic, keep trying to solve it. Come up with new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
With Olaf Evenjant, initially, the attraction to me was his discipline. His discipline in terms of this is how you assess A, B, C, D, and it gives you a real structure. It's almost like a military discipline. You don't have to think what you're doing. You just know that what you're doing is the correct pathway. And then I'd look at his techniques, and his techniques were always so precise and so deliberate.
Hmm.
He always had a biomechanical basis behind what he did.
Mm-hmm.
But he never settled for anything but perfection. And that was one of the things he kept saying. If you can't do it perfectly, then don't bother. Later on, of course, in the last few years of Dave Lamb's life, we had a meeting with Olaf where just the two of us had a class from him over 2 days. And it was the most phenomenal experience of my life. He taught us all of his new ideas, his new concepts in terms of mobilization. And that's really, a lot of that is the basis of the book that I eventually wrote and what I teach
mm-hmm.
in level four especially. We have adapted it, and he's okay with those adaptations because different countries will see different pathologies. Also, different countries have different cultures. So we've changed it slightly, but we've always had a very good relationship and have deep mutual respect. But I must say, probably one of the things that I reflect more than anything is the discipline of his tuition. The interesting thing is a lot of people look at that and they say it's boring. You're still teaching the same thing that you did 10 years ago, which isn't true.
Right.
I'm still teaching the same discipline I did 10 years ago, and that, as I've mentioned on the course, you know, you shouldn't have to make decisions at every level. They've already been made
right.
by logic. So keep following that.
It's pretty interesting. With my interview with Bruce, listeners who haven't gone and listened to that, go back and listen to it. But one of the things that was after the interview, he and I were just talking, and he said that he was fortunate enough to take a course from Olaf Evenjant. And I think he was either the only American or one of only two Americans and a couple of Canadians, and then the rest were all Europeans in the course. And he was saying, you know, for somebody as skilled as Bruce is, to watch Olaf or any of the other European physiotherapists, he was blown away by their precision and their skill. I mean, you know, Bruce is no slouch. He was just telling me that I felt like I had so much skill to still refine, and I thought I was pretty good going into the course, but after, you know, seeing people in that course, you realize that no, I've got a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to realize that, yes, yeah, as good as you are, there's still a lot to learn, a lot to refine, a lot to
yeah, but that kind of humility defines the person. Yeah. Because if he's prepared to say that, then what he's also saying is, I'm still open to learning forever.
Right.
Keep it coming, and I'll learn it.
Right, exactly. So that's why we gravitate toward those people.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing about manual therapy, especially at this level. You tend to attract, or the system tends to attract, good people, mm-hmm. nice people that care for other people. Because some of the work you have to do, if you weren't a caring individual, you couldn't tolerate it. It's too stressful. It's too strenuous on your body. And in many cases, it's too sad and depressing
yep.
to sort of see what's happened to people's lives from just simple musculoskeletal dysfunction. So I think that's a compliment that I would pay to every person who comes on my courses. You know, if you're bothering to do that, then you've obviously chosen to do the hard way. And you know, you really have to respect that.
Yeah, that's good to know. Well, I think I've heard you say it in courses before with Syriacs, you know, all the different things that he's remembered for. I think I've heard you say that he had said, if there's one thing he could be remembered for, it would be the selective tissue tension testing. So, you know, obviously he's not around anymore, and his work is still being carried on. If for, you know, those of us out there who may not have an opportunity to learn from you, but get to hear something like this interview on this blog, is there anything in particular you'd like to be remembered for, whether it's concept or, you know, who you are as an individual that cares for his community, anything in particular that you'd like to contribute to the physical therapy world?
Well, I've been recognized for my contribution towards clinical reasoning and biomechanics, and I think that's neat that I was able to do that. I still think, and that's confirmed in the latter years, that we've really got to keep pushing as a profession to work hard at becoming really good at what we do. And that should be our stamp on the medical world, that we have a specialty that nobody else can fulfill, and we need to be the best we can be for that reason. And so just keep pushing caring people towards a more community model and away from a corporate model.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the two different physio worlds coexisting, and that's fine. They can coexist, but I know which part of the world I want to be in.
Yeah.
And that's why I said that's my opening statement. If I've felt good about anything, you know, that song, The Man in the Mirror, you know, if mm-hmm. you wake up in the morning and you look in the mirror and it's like, okay, was yesterday a good day or a bad day? And if you're turning around and saying, no, I feel really crappy about myself, then things need to change.
Yeah.
But finally, I think after all these years, I managed to have gotten to where I want to be.
That's great to hear. If there's anything that's come to your mind since we've been talking, any other things to mention that we haven't talked about that you'd like to bring up, I'd like to give you that opportunity.
I think, you know, one of the things that I've actually been criticized for, but at the same time revered for, is designing things, designing new ideas, like the trigeminal symptoms, like the functional shoulder girdle, the Zoës pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And you get criticized because people are saying, oh, you're establishing all these rules, regulations, and ideas that have no actual basis. Well, I've never published anything that didn't have a basis in anatomy and biomechanics. So I would totally disagree there. But what I am doing in many instances is coming up with an idea and throwing it out and saying, okay, what do you make of that? So if you take any of those ideas as being gospel, then you're being quite silly, and that wasn't my intention. But at the same time, if you're criticizing them because it's from my imagination or I've developed it from what I do know, clinical reasoning and so on, then that's wrong too. And you need to encourage future thought. You need to encourage future development ideas in our profession. It's where we've come from over the last 100 years. And this new idea that you don't need to work hard, everything should be based on research, I think is threatening to bring the profession, or at least the advancement of the profession, to a halt. And I think we need to fight that as a group, especially within manual therapy.
Yeah, I'd agree. It certainly makes you more of a technician than an actual professional, and a critical thinker and highly skilled professional.
Yeah.
It turns you more into a technician that see this, do that.
Yeah, if you look at from 1916 in Canada alone, it's been 100 years since the Canadian system, the system was assessed. The physio was around a long before that. And so it's taken us almost 100 years to get the respect, mutual admiration of the medical profession. And in other countries like Australia, Britain, Norway, they're getting so many more accolades in terms of, oh, you're good enough, you can now prescribe drugs, you can do injections into joints, you can refer for x-rays and scans. It's only happened because of our push towards excellence, our push towards always learning more, inventing more ideas, and becoming more medically competent.
Yeah.
And I think that has to continue. Why, after 100 years, do we want to go back from whence we came?
Yeah.
I definitely don't want to be doing that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a lot about being, like I was saying, a professional and taking that as a big responsibility to continue on what others before you have worked so hard to do. And, you know, advance that line, so to speak, for the people that are coming behind you.
Yeah, well, there was a movie a little while ago called Passing It Forwards, or Paying Forwards.
Oh, Pay It Forward?
Yeah, instead of paying back people that helped you, then pay it to the next generation in the hope that they will pay for the next generation and so on. And I think certainly the teachers that I've had have done that, and so that's been a real stimulus to me to influence my generation to do the same thing, passing it on to you guys so that when you get to the same position, you can continue that ideology. The idea that you keep taking what's in it for me, I think is one of the poorer sides of our profession, and I think people I know anyway in manual therapy are definitely not following that mentality.
Right. Well, we certainly covered a lot, and I really appreciate, you know, all the time that you've given me today. Maybe next time I see you in December, we can maybe do it again and get to hear your thoughts on a few more things.
Yeah.
Because time's limited today, unfortunately, but thank you.
So that could also be called half a century in a few minutes.
Very easily. So, again, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Anytime.